Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice TV. Thanks so much for joining us, whether you're tuning into the podcast radio version of the show or if you're joining us watching the video version either on redicemembers.com or on redice.tv or our YouTube channel or any of the other channels that we are available on. Thank you so much for joining us. Hope you're all doing good today. We have a really interesting guest with us today, Richard Hauck. He actually was with us in one of our live streams before, but he's joining us today to talk about a book, a new release called Liberalism Unmasked. And it's called a description for the book is that it's a treatise against the left, diagnoses and disarms modern liberalisms with its theory of liberalism as a diagnosable mental illness. And this is kind of interesting because Lana just did a show with another gal about this amazing poll. It was pretty interesting looking at the left and looking how it's kind of a cult. And of course, we have heard for some time now about this issue that it is and it's acting like a mental illness. So we're actually going to dive deeper into this with Richard today. But thank you so much for coming on, first of all. It's good to have you back again.
Hey, thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
You bet. So when you were with us on the live stream, it was kind of a short and kind of it's more difficult to kind of get a background on people. As a lot of people come and go during those live streams. But why don't you just introduce yourself a little bit? Tell us how you ended up writing the book.
Sure. I really started writing and got the idea for it in my last year in undergrad. It was in 2016-2017 year. So you had the election going on, and I was at a big state school. And on the campus was really like, it was like ground zero for a lot of political happenings. There were protests all the time, anti-Trump protests, Black Lives Matter protests. There was a terrorist attack on campus one day on my way into school. School got closed. There was a young lady who I was going to graduate with who was killed right before graduation. There was the whole election thing going on all through this. So it was really, I had kind of politics coming at me just every single day I would go to school. And on top of those things I just mentioned, every class I had, regardless of what it was, it could have been, there was a cognitive neuroscience class I had where the professor went on a long rant about how silly he thought immigration was, in the sense that he didn't think you should have to have a piece of paper, as he called it, to become an American. You should just show up and be an American. And, this had nothing to do with the class. It was just his open border policy coming out. So going through this year, or that year rather, in undergrad, I started to really think a lot more about politics and then more so the mind of a liberal. So that's sort of how it all started. Around that time, I first started writing some essays. The first couple, well, I think I have a few now over at the Occidental Observer, and I have some stuff over at Countercurrents now also. First couple essays I wrote were actually refutations of things that were coming up in class. I had a class that was very much a critical race theory base that was all these studies about psychology of bias, stereotyping, and racism. And it was all from the perspective of so-called racist white people and something is wrong with them. And it sort of made a pathology out of these people. So one of the essays I wrote early on was an argument against right-wing authoritarianism and Bob Altmaier's work, who put together this right-wing authoritarianism scale. So it was kind of the early writings I did were sort of reactionary to things that were being taught in these classes, in these like upper level psych and sociology classes. From there, in and out, it's kind of funny now, really. I kept a secret, I call it a secret notebook just because, I never really show it to anybody. But I would document like behaviors and quotes that I heard from my professors and other students of just like absurd things they would say. Or the professor, I had a professor one time tell me that he made a comment that white people use more welfare than all the other groups. And I raised my hand and I said, well, what about, at a per capita basis, what does the rate of welfare look like between races. You know, I had already seen the data, so I knew. And, you know, he got very, like, offended and just, you know, kind of hurried on to the very next thing. And it was like it didn't even happen. So I bring this entirely legitimate concern up that if you're going to compare the largest population group in the country to everybody else, for you have that's not a fair comparison. You have to use some sort of per capita or by rate basis. Anyway, you know, so I would write that down, and anytime anything bizarre like that would come up, I would write it down. And then I started to formulate all these common patterns that I was finding. And that is sort of the basis for my analysis of liberalism as somewhat of a pathology. And like I said, it was also a reaction to all these classes, these psychology and sociology classes that treat whiteness, essentially, normal white feelings, as a pathology. So that's the basic kind of where it came from, where the sort of where I was radicalized story, I guess, right in the heart of academia. A lot of times people think we're these like really weird fringe people that like only exist in some movie character, but it was, you know, I was getting a good liberal arts education, and that's where it came from.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's a good point. I mean, it's these universities, of course, are in environments now where you can't question anything. It used to be very much about the questioning of the system and of them, using your mental faculties and trying different theories, and it's become just a super restrictive echo chamber. And maybe we can go into that a little bit later and also, of course, kind of talk about your diagnosis of this as a mental illness. That's a very, it's an important and interesting, development of the argument against liberalism, because, it seems to operate on a collective mind. It seems to be hysterical. It seems to be irrational. There's so many things with it that we can kind of decode and look at. But just for as a definition of terms and things like this, Richard, and the history of liberalism, where do you just, out of curiosity, where do you place some of the origins of some of these ideas? Because obviously if we look at the kind of classical liberalist movement, that was a different thing. Even to America was founded on some of those principles. Of course, we had liberalist revolutions in France and other European countries and things like that. But you mentioned to me the Wilson era. That's kind of where you draw back some of those ideas. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I think in regards to American politics particularly, that you can really see in the Wilson era the beginning of what we know as liberalism now. And the political parties starting with the Wilson era also, I think everything started shifting more and more left. You see a change from the maybe the legacy progressives like Theodore Roosevelt to this sort of social egalitarian progressivism. You see a huge amount of what the foreign policy known as liberal internationalism or Wilsonianism, which is very much like a neocon Trotskyism also. I talk about that in the book, the relation to Wilson's liberal internationalism theory and foreign affair policy to Trotsky's idea of permanent revolution. So I think before that, in American history particularly, you have different periods where things kind of ebbed and flowed left and right. And before that, it's hard to trace a party. Even now, I don't think you can really trace a party. You can't say that Republicans are just right wing or Democrats are just left wing. Party ideologies throughout history in different political eras shift. There was at times when what was the Democratic Party had, a lot of what we would look at now as right wing politics, and it even was back then. So this idea that in modern times that like the Democrats are the real racists because of Andrew Jackson or because of post-Reconstruction Democrats in the South or because of the Klan, things like that, I think it's very hard to trace that party to the current party. They could really exactly. be called entirely different names. And if you look at the different political eras and demarcations in ideology, you see that. I think if you're serious about the political history. But with the Wilson era, we start getting into things like the income tax. We get the Federal Reserve. We get World War One. It kind of steps back a little bit with the next couple Republican presidents who don't like that sort of progressivism. But for the most part, they weren't able to roll anything back. Then you get the FDR era. You get the New Deal coming out of it. You get the freedoms from want, which really establishes an early like wealth redistribution scheme that isn't, I guess you could call these are sort of socialist principles in ways, using the more Marxist egalitarian term of socialism, not so much the idea, not so much the Nordic model, and which is also delineation there. But the language is similar, so I think it's confusing to some people. So that's where I see the whole thing starting. In regards to the underpinning of these ideas, a lot of it is very much classic Marxism. You have some classic Marxism, and then particularly it all really kicks off with cultural Marxism. Frankfurt School teachings that you can trace, that all of that stuff, there is a very direct line to Marxist theories, Frankfurt School theories, to modern liberalism that you see in universities, and from the American, the so-called right. I talk about in the book Neoconservatism as really a left-wing un-American movement. That I really is very pretty close to any sort of liberalism or the Democratic Party. So especially socially, you see a lot of the Frankfurt School and the cultural Marxism influence more than really any other single ideology. That plays out over and over and over again. And if you're, I think it really does anybody a lot of good to read, some of those early communist writers, because you see how influential their theories were and where we end up today with it. I do a little analysis at one point in the book where I talk about Marx's 10 pillars of communism or 10 planks of communism and how they relate to current American policy and how many things have been implemented from Marx's ideas. And so these are things that you get really far away from with classical liberalism and more into a Marxist model.
Yeah, I mean, it has transformed significantly over the time, which things does, of course, it makes sense. But what I found interesting with it too is that it has moved from something which was, philosophy, was something regarding economics, social ideas, psychology, somewhat arguable ideas and things like this, into a highly emotional, irrational movement, which today is, I think I liken it best by the invasion of the body snatchers or something like that, where, it jumps from one person to another, it's taking over like a hive mind, and whoever is outside of that, you get that like just, scream, the mass collective is screaming and they've found one which is deviant, which is not part of the collective. And it has become really hysterical. We've seen that, of course, really bloom, Richard, in the wake of the Trump win and everything like that. And I mean, people remember the scenes of the ladies just, screaming and people screaming at the sky and stuff like that. What would you say to this particular way that liberalism or the progressive movement have transformed from, cultural Marxism and things like this, into just a childlike state of unacceptance of reality itself?
That is one of the things I kind of talk about in sort of the liberal mind. And I experienced this a lot on campus, where you couldn't even bring up something reasonably. Like, I never would get into like screaming matches or arguments with people. I would just try to bring up reasonable points in almost a Socratic way. I'd say, yeah, but what about this study? And I might, like, pull it up on my computer, and people would just lose their minds on me. And I think this goes hand in hand with the appeal of liberalism. The appeal of liberalism and the fact that in America particularly, there's been no true right-wing party or even real semblance of right-wing thought anywhere in the mainstream for decades. You might have a stray person here or there, the stray book, or, you know, the stray interview on Fox News, but for the most part, the entire political spectrum in the U.S. is entirely accepting of left-wing values. So you have a couple things going on. One is across the board, whether it's GOP or DNC, you have people essentially who are open border globalists. They're not nationalists whatsoever. They don't care how many people come into the country. They don't care how much these people cost. There's this idea that America should be open to everybody, free to everybody, and you should come here no matter what. I mean, you see that from, you know, the Gang of Eight people. You see it in Reagan when he signed in the amnesty bill. And it wasn't that, you know, I don't want to blame Reagan for it, but there was no, like, real opposition to this. It went through. So one of the things is that American leftists have been getting their way for like 100 years. Everything that they really wanted, they got. And it may have taken a long time, but whatever they wanted a heavy progressive income tax. They got it. They wanted open borders. They got it. And we have we have high tax rates. We have a million people coming into the country a year. Any sort of foreign aid they wanted to send, any sort of military interventions they want, they got. They just, you know, over and over and over again, the American left are like the most prolific winners of all time, as much as I hate to say it. But they've, you know, had one hell of a 100 years. So you have that. So this is the situation we've created, right? This like history of winning. And you also have...
Sorry, Richard, let me just mention quick then. Which means that they have not had any true opposition, which means that they have not become really good at debating or good at arguing with people, good at fighting back to a certain extent with people. They've been strong because they did win, as you say, but this has made them weak over time, as you say, because if you don't exercise, you know, your defense mechanism, if there's no opposition, if there's nothing to fight against them for, really, to a certain extent, they have just devolved into this, pack of kindergartners that just can scream. They just scream at getting everything, you know. It's just,
yeah.
And it's like they don't understand reality. But what's bizarre and what's scary is that these people and this mentality is still, of course, actually ruling us today. You know, ruling the culture.
Oh, it absolutely is. It has all the institutions. Has a tremendous amount of political power. Tremendous amount of money. Even if you look at the elections, the 2016 elections of spending and donations, I mean, Hillary received and spent far more money than Donald Trump did. Bernie Sanders raised a considerable amount of money. Even like Jill Stein raised a ton of money. There's just, they have, yeah, they're like serial winners, in a lot of ways. And then, so on top of that, that's the atmosphere they're in. And then the whole ideology of liberalism is sort of an ideology for weak-minded, feeble-minded people. It's sort of, although they're winners in a systemic sense, these people individually, I think the ideology individually appeals to like the weak and the loser type. And what I mean by that is it's an ideology that you'd think a child would have has never lived in the real world. You know, this idea that we can solve world hunger by just letting everybody here, and countries that are, you know, in the throes of hostile conflict, we can solve it by sending them some food and some aid money and letting everybody come here, and let's just invite everybody in and we'll all get along. And that's really the idea, the crux of liberalism and globalism at the very petty individual level. On a broader scope, I think it's far more insidious than that. But the individual, the screaming cat lady, the purple-haired freak show, that sort of thing, they just think, why would you be mean and exclude these people? Why don't you want a bunch of poor, downtrodden Somalis living in your backyard? Like, they are wonderful. You're going to have awesome, halal carts and falafel stands and whatnot. So I think that is another appeal to it. This sort of, feel good, you can help everybody out, egalitarian high that people get from it. So those two things create a situation where you have people that are used to winning and kind of an immature ideology. And when they lose, when they get a little pushback, they lose their mind. They don't know how to deal with it. They never in their entire lives, no person who is working right now anywhere in the press and the media as a journalist, these people have never been called out by the president.
Yep.
They've never been called a pack of liars. They've never been booed at Trump rallies. They've never gone to cover a presidential race and been booed and people give them the finger. I mean, there's videos of, 5-year-old kids in MAGA hats giving journalists the finger. It's really great. And they've never seen this kind of thing before. So I think that's where you get this kind of meltdown in this. And they're also losing power. And they feel that. And that is another, they're hysterically lashing out at the loss of power.
Absolutely. And this is, of course, one of the big highlights, I think, of the Trump presidency, of him calling them out in such a way that no one ever has before. And we've never seen, it's kind of taking it in a different direction, but we can just dwell on it for a moment, just try to reflect on it, of how the media establishment is treating Trump and treating Trump supporters and the way that they're justifying violence in the way that we've seen CNN defend Antifa now several times, even bloomed up just a couple of days ago. Again, another CNN contributor went off the rails. He was talking about how great they are, and Cuomo, Chris Cuomo, he was doing it just a week or so before that. And there's a handful of media companies kind of at the center of this, obviously, but the way that Trump has pointed this out has really showed them what screaming little pansies, what babies they are, really, that they can take any kind of criticism. So it's a really interesting point in American history in terms of what's going to happen, because, as you know, Rich, I mean, this is now coupled with kind of the censorship that we've started to see, a way for the liberal democratic, really, establishment in America trying to hijack the public discourse by blocking voices that they don't approve of, that they don't like. They're using social media at the same time. They're using the big media companies to kind of promote who to ban, like they did with Alex Jones, for example. And it's no matter how you turn and twist this, it is a very strictly authoritarian system, which, of course, these people claim at the bottom of things to be ultimately against, right?
Oh, absolutely. I talk about that a bit, how they are, in their effort to fight what they consider to be fascism, they have become full-blown leftist authoritarians. They're full-blown, Stasi NKVD Bolshevik-style leftist at this point. And things have gotten really polarized as a result. They're doing the Soviet style speech control. They have these virtual hanging orders. They have, an Article 58 in place where any dissidents are to be fired and, excommunicated. Everything's really ramping up. And I think it's because the political arguments now are, the stakes are very, very high. The argument of migration and what to do with the, million people flooding into your country and tens of millions of illegals, the outcome of that will fundamentally change the nation. And the same thing that's happening, you can basically say identically of what is happening in many European countries. The outcome of the immigration debate, whoever wins that, will forever change the course of those nations. So it's a huge debate. It's no longer a debate of increasing tax rates by a couple percent or making certain firearms legal yet more difficult to access. You know, those really, when you look back in history at some of the political debates that were fought fiercely, especially early on in this country after the revolution, the things that people were fighting about, were killing each other about, were that they were imprisoning each other over their political enemies. These were very, very petty, small political arguments comparing to what we are seeing today with the migration schemes, the predatory migration schemes, with the tax structure, with the way they want to totally silence any dissident voices. They have this idea that they love to say, and I mention it in the book in sort of a lighthearted way, kind of turning their own ideas on them about the marketplace of ideas. They always talk about, you know, this marketplace of ideas, but they don't want, they, you know, it would be great if they would allow us to participate in the marketplace of ideas, but they don't want to. They're not interested in that. They're interested in entirely dominating the market. So, I agree with you. The stakes are really, really jumping up. And I think it's because the entire fate of civilizations are starting to ride on things politically, on political questions. And that, in a lot of ways, is, something you don't often see in the history of nations.
It's an amazing time to be alive. It's tumultuous. It's chaotic. As you say, I don't think we've seen anything like this ever in history. You can go back to the catastrophe to a certain extent of the migration era, you know, 400s, 500s, 600s, but it's still nothing like what we've seen. And the lid has been held on so long as well, but we're seeing this bubbling out and we're seeing expressions of discontent, which is so heightened that I think it's something's going to give, something's going to blow, something is going to dramatically change as kind of the system and the structure begins to lose its control over people and the dialogue and the culture.
Yeah, I agree. Things definitely are getting more serious and going to start coming to a head. They just cannot continue on the path they're on. Particular to America with a million or more people coming into the country each year. It's entirely unsustainable, especially when you look at the use of taxes and crime rates of these people who come in. And the data basically shows white people pay the vast majority of taxes, a rate higher than what they represent in the population. So I think they pay 75% of more of the taxes while being 60% of the population. And there are some groups of people who are almost entirely on welfare. You have several Arab countries where 90% of the people from these nations are on welfare. You have something like 70-75% of people coming from Mexico and Central America, those households on welfare. And it's at some point there essentially won't be enough white people to pay taxes to support everybody else.
Yeah.
And the whole, the whole system kind of starts to, it's like this great pyramid scheme and it starts to crumble. It really is a pyramid scheme. They bring in more people, they, print more money, they pretend the economy's growing, and it's an entirely unsustainable method of growth.
It's a house of cards. It's going to come crashing down.
Yeah, it is a house of cards. Yep. And it creates, I heavily cite diversity research in my book because it creates a very hostile living environment for everybody,
yeah,
but particularly for white people. And I say particularly for white people because although the research shows that racially diverse nations have more conflict, they have lower social cohesion, they have lower interpersonal trust, there are also some there is some interesting things that, for example, white nations are generally very high trust, and Arab, Hispanic, and African nations are generally very low trust. So when you mix these people together, not only do you have lower trust and lower civil engagement altogether, you have white people who are used to functioning historically for all of our history in these high trust societies, and then you're lowering that trust and bringing in people who are used to functioning in lower trust societies. So for them, it's not really vastly different, but for us, it is wildly different. You know, it changes the entire fabric of our societies and civilizations. Just on one aspect, just on the trust aspect, that then of course destroys social capital and leads to all sorts of things like people staying inside more. People don't even get as much exercise in racially diverse cities. So it affects your health. You see people less. You don't go vote as much. You don't participate in civic projects. So a lot of the things that you see that are really exceptional about white communities, seeing people volunteering for organizations, doing charity events, doing soup kitchens, all that stuff starts to go away too. And then, of course, there's the tax rate. We disproportionately pay for it all. And then there's the crime rate. The crime rate of these people that are coming is higher than the white crime rate. People often make this comparison that the Hispanic and migrant crime rate of these people that are coming is lower than the overall crime rate for the U.S. But if you break the U.S. crime rate down by race, what you see is that what's happening is that the black crime rate is so high, it inflates the numbers for all of the U.S. So if you would parse these out by race, you see black crime rate's the highest. Native-born Hispanics are next, and then the Hispanics that are migrating to the U.S. have about the same crime rate as the Hispanics born in the U.S., and then way below that is the white crime rate. So although through, you know, the average, the American average, seems to be higher, for white people it's not. So the introduction of Hispanics and blacks and Africans into white neighborhoods does raise the crime when you look at it that way. So, you know, we have destroyed social capital. And then there's the interracial rate of crime is highest of crime against white. So you see white people victimize other races at a very low rate, but white people are victimized at a disproportional rate by both blacks and Hispanics. It's at a rate way beyond what you would account for the disparate population sizes. So the data actually looks like whites and Hispanics, if they have the choice, choose white victims of violent crimes, whether it's mugging, rape, murder, all of these things. So in every aspect, any sort of measurable aspect you can see to these predatory migration schemes, you see it's very, very, very damaging to white society, more so than any negative effects that would be seen by migrants or like non-white neighborhoods, for example.
Yeah.
And it just can't continue. I mean, it's something at some point, there's not going to be any more Aspen, Colorados or Martha's Vineyards for white people to run to. And, throughout history, you see when the tectonic plates of civilizations and races collide, you always have conflict. There's no examples of there not being ethnic conflict when these disparate groups are in close proximity together. So it's just the people that say it can work out and diversity is a strength and that we just need to assimilate or just need to teach them their values. That is the true utopian vision. Those are the people really detached from reality. I mean, and they don't have any examples of it working. It's a pipe dream. The reality is that, you know, you end up with the ethnic conflict.
Yeah, indeed. I'm just showing some footage here of some of the recent boats that was coming into Spain, some of the migrants there. And in many parts at the same time, and I'm bringing up Europe now, because as you accurately said, we really have a movement which truly has become international and global in that sense. But, of course, the West is spearheading. We're leading this. We're pushing this. We're being the victims of this first, obviously, too. But kind of the mentality of America has really been transplanted, and it's kind of ruling in Europe as well. And so we're seeing the effects of the globalization process, of what these globalists want to do with us. They're seeing an international world order. And as you said, you can pin that back to the fact that many of these high rollers in organizations that are, you know, deciding these kinds of things, like the UN, for example, who are pushing, you know, population replacement and stuff like that. You have people like the current president, who actually is a former member of Socialist International, for example, right? I forget his name now, the guy. It'll come to me in a minute. But there's so many of those people that truly have this international kind of worldview, how they see things, how they want to transform and change, really, the world. The thing, though, is that the problems are so vast and so many, and they're pushing so hard, Richard, that I think it's going to collapse for them before this vision up there is going to fully manifest. But maybe that was the idea all along. Maybe it was more about the destruction of our societies than the achievement of some grandiose utopia where everyone is getting along, right? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, that is a good question. A lot of people try to reach this utopia, but I often think that, you know, like Marxism and all of its flavors that you see wasn't ever about a utopia. It was about creating an overclass of people and then an entire underclass of people. It sort of was always a supremacist view. And although, you know, Marx and the Frankfurt School and then all the critical theory that came of it do teach us egalitarianism, always in practice, you know, everywhere this is put in, you have a group of people who are the elite within this organization. So if it's, you know, if there's a hierarchy to everything, whether it's in a socialist, legitimate socialist style country with central ownership and no private property, there's a hierarchy. In the cases of like critical race theory, there's always this victim hierarchy, and then there are the people like the sociology professors who are teaching this language about white privilege and cisgendered and ableism and all of the whole vocabulary and vernacular that comes with it. They get to be sort of the arbiters of this. They're like the commissars in the party. You know, they are the elite, and then they dictate it to everybody else. And so that's always been the historical structure of Marxism and all these movements. And it's the same way with liberalism. And you see it kind of, it's sort of funny. I mean, it's funny, but it's not, I get a little bit of dark irony, I guess, out of it, where you see these things like black trans women telling gay Jewish men that they actually are more privileged than that group, and that they need to be to, you know, lend their voices to the black trans women as gay Jewish men, because as gay Jewish men, they have more systemic advantages than a black trans woman. So you see this thing like kind of starting to eat itself in some ways. And it is funny, but it's also kind of sad.
No, it's, you know, funny. It's only funny, and we should make fun of it.
So
and it's a hierarchy, and yeah, exactly. And who determines what and but what happens, of course, is there isn't consensus. This is what's interesting too, because it does begin to fall apart. If these groups were left to their own devices, if there was no white society there, really civil society that was there to kind of maintain, you know, order and law and structure, they would turn on each other in 2 seconds. It's beginning to eat itself, and I think that we should take advantage of that, because it truly has become, you know, if we zoom back to that a little bit or move back towards that a little bit, that let's try to diagnose it as a mental illness. You have, of course, in the book, you have a chapter on this or a part of this, and you're talking about making that as a criteria, like diagnostic criteria of a mental illness. Talk about this a little bit and how we should approach it and look at it.
I think, it's definitely interesting of how to approach it. I approach it, first of all, as a very immature and irrational ideology, as something that is very, there's a very antisocial aspect to it all, which kind of manifests as this sort of weird lack of morality, or this very relative morality. I don't really engage leftists, including like the neocon types, very much anymore, whether it's online or in person. I don't even argue with them because I find most of them to, they are so interested in their dogmatic worldview. They will lie. You'll show them statistics. They will say this source is not reliable. You show them FBI data from last year. They say, well, what about this year? You know, as if it would have somehow swung wildly in some other direction. There's a lot of projection. There's a lot of doublethink, a lot of cognitive rigidity, where they have the inability to adjust their belief as new data is presented. They always feel that they are morally superior, and particularly in the white liberal category, there is this. There's a lot of self-hatred and guilt. You know, we call it white guilt or ethnomasochism or xenophilia, the kind of this love for the other.
Yeah.
You see that manifest itself a lot. And I talk about these criteria and the way they play out through a variety of topics throughout the book.
You said, quickly, let me interject. You said that historically that, of course, that the love for the other or the out-group preference, whether that's, I don't know, actually bypassing some instinctual processes that they have, I don't know, do they override these instincts, basically? That could be theorized. And maybe some do, maybe others don't. They see the social score points more important than actually adhering to these instinctual things, which, you know, does favor in-group, you know, in-group mentality. But you said that historically that this is a deviant behavior, if you can put it that way. It's a behavior which has not been traditional, and those who probably favor those things, if there ever was a group that did that, they definitely are not around to show us that anymore. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Evolution should have selected for strong in-group preference, and I think it did. And it had to. And so the fact that any of these people are around is really kind of remarkable in that sense, because you would have thought after thousands of years of tribal and ethnic conflict in humans that anybody who showed an out-group preference would have basically had their genetic lineage eradicated. These would have been very dangerous for most of human history to see a group of foreign aliens, particularly of like fighting age males, and to run up and like welcome them. It's just as dangerous as it is now, actually, as it was then. But what's surprising is they made it this far along. And I don't know if they are if it's like a cognitive override of these like basic biological behaviors. It might be. I think a lot of it is a cognitive override, and we do live in a safer society in a lot of ways.
Sure.
Where you don't always have to. Well, this is
for
changing.
Now.
But I was
exactly.
I was going to say you don't have to walk with your tribe down the street. But I was going to say some places you actually do.
That's right.
So you know, maybe as they realize that more and more. That'll change.
It's a recent phenomenon, though, Richard. Right? I mean, these people. It's not that they have. I think had a progression through evolution where they had, you know, these a mentality of outgroup preference that which made them survive. That's certainly not it. It's like it's propaganda. It's mind control. It's coercion. It's subversion. It's all these psychological processes of getting people to favor an abnormal behavior, and then think they're doing the right thing, as you say, a kind of a moral supremacism, and this is enough to sustain them because we're not really subjected to these natural dangers that we were in the past, although that's now returning. And that's also why I think a lot of people they're walking away, right? They're shifting mentality. They're changing as they're seeing realities encroaching onto them, and they're realizing, wait a minute, these no-go zones in Sweden or these areas in the UK where I can't longer go as a native, you know, That's wrong. Something is wrong there. They're seeing that, and they're making the choice of saying, you know, maybe these nationalists or people who are promoting a non-multicultural society has a lot more sense. They're bringing something which is far more valuable and important than just advocating for open borders and mass, you know, diversity and multiculturalism.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is that most people who advocate these sort of things that are the loudest about it are generally very hypocritical, and they have this double think. I had professors that could have lived a block from campus and got a $500 apartment and had their cars broken into every day. It was a very diverse neighborhood too. They would have loved all the little street carts, I'm sure, but they chose to live an hour away in a suburb that was 90% plus white and send their kids to private schools, incidentally. So these were some of the people who were the biggest proponents of multiculturalism and diversity, and they would teach these studies that would show, you know, they would try to show diversity is good anyway. The studies were always very faulty and left out pertinent data. But they would, you know, on one hand, they would say, you know, this is great, we should welcome everybody, but not to my neighborhood, not to my kid's private school. So you also see, and I talk about that, there's this doublethink, and there's this hypocrisy, and there's this holding conflicting views, and there's this cognitive dissonance within the liberal mind, because, you know, they might preach that, yeah, it's a great article, but they might preach diversity and whatnot, but they don't actually live it. So the people who do have a legitimate out-group preference, they are that is not something evolution would have selected for. That is not something ever seen in human history. It's a very, very bizarre trait to have. But those who the other group that don't legitimately have an out-group preference in their lifestyle, they suffer from the cognitive dissonance. So either way, it's very much a catch-22 for liberals, especially the way I've kind of formulated this list of psychological traits in the liberal mind. There's no way they can escape it, because they're not being honest with themselves, or they're exhibiting this weird behavior that would have got them killed, you know, not too long ago in human history. And I think that's kind of one of the more clever aspects of the book that I'm kind of proud of, is that there's, you know, either way they try to explain it, they're sort of caught in this web that I put together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. it's true. Jared Taylor referenced, I think it was Sam Francis, I think it was Sam Francis' words on this. He said the liberal is, you know, if you look at their migratory and like mating habits, as you call it, they're no different from a Ku Klux Klan member or something like that, which is kind of funny, you know.
Yeah.
And it's true. They choose all these, you know, white areas, and of course from that, from their ivory towers, to a certain extent, they're advocating for what poor whites should have, or you should live in a diverse neighborhood, and it's completely, you know, unrealistic in terms of the experiences that these people really have on the ground. And you know, just quickly, one example we saw today, of course, in Sweden, the Alternative for Sweden had a demonstration in Uddevalla and actually had a huge, they were attacked by this immigrant gang. Alternative for Sweden, of course, are the only party talking about re-migration. That's one of these issues, right? But it's interesting, too, that it's like the slightest little pushback, slightest little affirmation or expression of self-determination and saying, you know, we want our country back, is leading to violence, you know, almost immediately. It's very, very interesting. But this exposes it, too. It exposes migration. It exposes multiculturalism as an incredibly divisive issue, where it has been a incredibly splitting force. I mean, it's like Sweden never had these kinds of levels of arguments internally. Nothing had never divided the people this much. It's a horrible situation. But as you know, we were talking about, I think something will have to give. And these examples, and we can just show some of the footage from there, that it started to go kind of heated up slowly, and then eventually there was a scuffle between some of the AFS members. And these are members of parliament that was assaulted violently You know, and of course, it doesn't seem to be that bad, to be honest, as things progress. But still, it's this guy was one of them that was targeted. He was hit in the face. You know, someone was spitting on him and stuff like that. It's turning into a big story. But, you know, regardless, Rich, this is a very interesting development in terms of how, you know, that this exposes something in our societies which is completely unsustainable at this point, unattainable. And I only think it's going to get worse and worse as soon as we see a little bit of expression of, like, trying to regain control of our own countries. It turns violent. The extreme left is there backing up these people, of course. But usually it's immigrant gangs that were going after these people. So we'll have to see how this kind of turns out. But, you know, this is maybe a separate issue. It's just one of the reflections of all the problems, really, that has come with liberalism. But before we take a break here, Rich, we're going to do that in a few minutes here. Tell us just how people can get a copy of the book. It was published by Arctos. It was released here just now, today, I believe, actually, as we're doing this recording. Yep. It's also available on Barnes and Nobles, I believe. Is this the best places to go?
Yep, you can get it from, you can go to the Arctos website. It's on Amazon, and it's on Barnes & Noble. And there's also an ebook coming, should be up in a couple of days. If you wanted, you know, download it to a Kindle, that version will be up also.
Okay, that's great. So Liberalism Unmasked is the title of the book, and there's a lot of good things in there. You really go through the history. It's a long kind of... It's really an effort to break this down and truly understand it. And as we continue in the second part, we can comment a little bit more in detail on what happened in Sweden. I can get your take on that as well. And then we can go into the mechanics of this as a mental illness, and also really, of course, how to fight back against this. What the consequences of this is going to be when it blooms out, and then of course what we can do to push back and fight back. But yeah, pick up a copy of the book, guys. Liberalism Unmasked. I like as well that it has graphically the They Live theme here with the glasses and everything. We could talk more about that in the second segment. But yeah, guys, we're just going to take a quick break. Then we'll be back with Richard Hauck. Stay tuned, everyone. We'll see you on the other side. Well, guys, join us in the second part at redicemembers.com as we continue with Richard Hauck to talk about his book, Liberalism Unmasked. And we're going into more detail about this event that happened in Sweden at the Alternative for Sweden's campaign. There was at a square meeting, and I just wanted to bring that briefly up as an example of how Swedish society is basically collapsing and how the police is losing control as well, and how we're seeing these scenarios arise where people are fighting each other. Tremendous division over these issues. So we go into detail in that much more. We get Richard's take on that, and we also, of course, go much deeper into what to do about liberalism, how to solve the issues, how we fight this disease, and how we can win against it. So a lot of good stuff is coming up, so please join us at redicemembers.com, part 2. Sign up for a membership, support us, make sure that we can continue. Thank you so much for your support, everyone out there. So good stuff coming up right after the break, so join us at the members website. We'll see you there. Thanks.